This is a passage that I think most people are familiar with, at least generally familiar with. I think it's a passage I have a particular fondness for. But if I'm honest, I don't know that I've ever really taken it seriously in a sense of application. It's something that I know Jesus did. I'm happy he did it, but I'm kind of not sure why I'm happy he did it. I just take kind of a sinister delight in it. But it actually, when you do the hard work of hermeneutics on this passage to try to figure out what does it actually mean for us, the church, today, not just as a historical event, like Jesus did this, but how do we apply this? It's actually very difficult. Because I think that represents an excuse that we make. Not yet. It's not time. You know, we'll bear fruit someday. You know, we'll bear fruit, when I finish college. Then I'll go bear fruit. I'm in a new job, and so until I kind of get my feet, and then I'll bear fruit. Or I'm in some kind of transition, or I'm in a new relationship, I just got married, so, it's not time to bear fruit. And I think, again, it's not about the justice of what's fair to the fig tree. It's about what the fig tree represents, which is Israel. And it's about Messiah coming to that tree and saying, I want something from you. I demand fruit. There should have been fruit on this tree. There isn't. And for that reason, I curse it, and it will die at its roots, all the way to its roots. Strong, strong language. This is not really the Jesus you're used to, is it? I mean, the whole tenor of this return to the temple, it's not what we're used to. It's not what we've come to expect of Jesus. He seems to be angry, even spiteful, taking his frustration out on a poor little fig tree. It almost seems private, like he's just having a bad day. And he's God, so when he has a bad day, things die, you know? And if we didn't know better, if we projected onto Jesus our own character traits, we would assume that's what's happening. We could even have that reaction for the merchants in the temple. I feel like these poor merchants, they're just trying to make a living. They aren't really doing anything wrong. But why is he so violent towards them? He's judging this fig tree because it's a symbol. And he's using it obviously as an illustration of the temple. Prosperity and peace, which the fig tree represented. The fig was this symbol of the godly man. And God was always looking for them. Jesus curses the fig tree as a foreshadowing of the events to come. He is critical of the tree in the same way that he will be critical of the temple system. And he curses them both because the one who created them both has arrived and he sees that neither has fruit. And it makes me ask the application question, if he were to come to us today, would there be leaves but no fruit? In other words, would there be signs of life? That obviously this tree is getting nutrients. It's being fed. It has enough sunlight. It has proper soil. It's getting enough water because it is leaf bearing, but there is no fruit. And the day before, this reminds me of last week, the day before when he walks in the temple and he looks around at everything and he decides, not today. I won't do it today. Remember that? And then he comes back tomorrow. And this is what he does. This is what he was thinking about the day before. This is what he was deciding if he had time to do it. Remember? Where he's looking around and he realized it was too late in the day, so they retreated back to Bethany, only to come back the next day to do this. This is the end of the triumphal procession in Jerusalem. This is his intention to come. It is his intention to come and to do what is called the cleansing of the temple. Cleansing also, that same that synonymous word for cleansing is the word pruning. To cut a thing back so that it can bear fruit. And if a vine does not bear fruit over and over, if pruning cannot save it, it must be uprooted. He assessed the temple system and he decided in judgment it was corrupt and it must be resisted, renounced, and withered to its roots. So he comes back the next day with a whip, with fire in his eyes, and this is not temper. It's not reactionary. It's premeditated and intentional and hold on, loving. Can someone like give the baby a bottle or something? Or what do we need to do? Get like a hug? So sad, isn't it sad? I'll give it a hug. Let's bring it down here. Aww. I just drove out a baby from this third temple. It's terrible. What a jerk. If you look at this in the terminology of history, this is a direct action protest. It is a direct action protest against the temple. It is vigorous action against false righteousness, and it is an action on behalf of the poor. See, not only is the temple no longer ushering in the presence of God and bringing sinners back into reconciled relationship with God, which was its intended purpose, it has actually become a place where people are exploited, taken advantage of for money, and this Jesus cannot abide. Now I want you to take note of that, because the same Jesus that walked the earth in Palestine 2,000 years ago is the Jesus we sang to this morning. And what we know from his earthly life is what he can and cannot abide. And he cannot abide a religious institution that exists for money. Primarily also for the exploitation of the poor. The very thing that was set up to bring wayward, lost, poor, broken people back to God becomes a thing that is there to exploit those people. To enrich those in leadership, religious leadership. He comes back to the center of Judaism, to the center of the city of Jerusalem, and this is the initial climax in Mark. This is the climax of the procession into the city. He is literally overturning the system that is in place, and he makes a mess of it. So let's look at the four things he actually does. In this passage, four things he actually does in the temple. Because again, like I said before, I've always been fond of this passage, but found it, I've never really been willing to wade into the waters of application here. So we're going to have the courage to do that this morning. Four things he actually does. Let's break it down. The first is he drives out those that are selling in the outer courts. He drives them out. Now we know from John's narrative that he has a whip, that he uses a whip to do that. And he is actually driving them from their place of selling out. And this is a fulfillment of a prophecy in Hosea, where God says, I will drive them out of my house because their rulers are disobedient. It's about those that are in power allowing those people to sit in the court of the Gentiles and to make it a place of commerce. You see, it is the buying and selling of the things necessary to be right with God, which is detestable to God. You see, if I need reconciliation with God, if I find myself being far from God, needing forgiveness from God, needing intimacy with God, needing the knowledge of God, needing to touch the things of God, and there is someone there saying, sure, you can come in if you pay. If you pay. If you buy what is for sale, then you can have that thing. Do you understand how infuriating that is to God. Because, you know, he's not getting a cut of that. Contrary to what they'll tell you, it does not go to them. It does not go to God, it goes to them. The second thing he does, so he drives out those that are selling. The second thing he does, he turns over the tables of the money changers. This is a different group of people. Money changers were the people who took foreign currency and translated it into, gave you in turn, local currency so that you could participate in the merchant system. So you've come to Jerusalem to make atonement with God, and you need a young bull or a ram, or you need doves or whatever. And so what do? You have to buy those. But the problem is you're a pilgrim. You've come from very far to make, to come to the center of Judaism so that you can make atonement with God. You can make sacrifice to God. But you don't have the right kind of money. So you have to take your money, your foreign currency, and trade it in for local currency. And there is an opportunity to make money. Anybody who's ever traveled internationally, you know you don't change your money at the airport. It's the worst exchange rate is at the airport. You just take that and multiply it by 10. This is what they were doing. Right there at the temple, you could change your money, but what they were doing was charging exorbitant rates for the changing of that money. So you might, for $1 to get exchanged into an equivalent dollar, you might pay a half a dollar. And that people are just getting rich off the fact that you are a foreigner, an alien, that you are an outsider, that you don't have local currency. And they're exploiting that truth, that the pilgrim that has come to make atonement with God is being exploited by the people that have received them. Instead of with hospitality, with opportunism. And then there is this reference to those selling doves. Now you have to understand, doves were, in the law, they were the requirement for those that could not afford a proper sacrifice. If you could not afford a proper sacrifice, instead you could offer two doves. Doves were the sacrificial piece that were used by the very poor, the severely poor. And those that sold doves did so in exploitation, not just in using the temple system for commerce, but using the temple system for commerce among the weakest and the poorest. Not just to become rich off of God and to become rich off of the things of God, but to become rich off the things of God offered to the poorest among them. And think of the double insult that this is to the poor. Already, Jesus in his ministry has come against the purity code. He's come against the temple code. He has repudiated the sacrificial code. He has come to say, I'm not connected to this. I don't believe that this is a way to come into intimacy with God. The debt code, all of that, he's already come against it in the Gospel of Mark. And here is this double insult, because these people are not only unclean and outcast in that system, but they have to pay more. So they're already outcast, treated as marginalized, as alienated, but then they have to pay more because of it. Because they're unclean, they have to make more sacrifices than everyone else. They have to pay into a system that was rejecting and alienating them. Not only were they considered inferior, but they had to pay more because of their inferior status. And then the third thing he does in this text is he forbids anyone from bringing merchandise in. So he drives out with a whip those that are selling. And then he looks over to the money changers, those that are making the sales possible through high interest, high rates of exchange, and he flips over their table. And then he blocks the way for anyone else to come in. Now, you have to understand, this is not just Jesus doing this alone. This is a team effort. I mean, how do you block all of the court of the Gentiles? How do you keep anyone from coming back in? It's not just Jesus driving them out. This is teamwork. This is not just all the disciples, but probably this whole crew of people that has followed him into Jerusalem. They're ready. This is their time. And they block the entry to the temple. Now, if you pay close attention to the text, it's not that you're not allowed in the temple. You just can't bring anything with you. Jesus makes coming into the temple only possible if you come without goods, you come empty-handed. See, guys, the temple was fundamentally had become an economic system. And so are some churches. Supply and demand, creating jobs, delivering a product, making those jobs and the delivery of that product interdependent. And this is the problem. It's not fundamentally about God anymore. It's about money, the jobs, and the commerce that it creates. I have friends who are in full-time professional ministry in churches. They say, Brian, I would leave tomorrow and come work with you. I want out of this thing, but I can't because it's my job. I wouldn't have money. And so they continue going on working in churches in our city as professional clergy, doing a thing they do not any longer believe in. Because what would they do otherwise? They have no money, no other way to get money. And that paycheck becomes the reason they do ministry. I got an email just recently from a guy I did not know, a stranger, emails me and says, I would like to make money. This is what the email said. I would like to make a living. I'm out of work, and I would like to make money by helping people. So can you please, hook me up with that? So in other words, I want to make a good living, and I want to help people. Can you hook me up with that? I mean, what do you think my response was? I said they're mutually exclusive. I said, your desire to find a job and your desire to help people, they compete with each other. You've got to pick one or the other. You either commit to the concept of helping people, and you may or may not get money for that. It cannot be about money. Or you commit to, I need to get a job and I'm going to go work for somebody and I'm just going to work, punch in, get my pay, and that's fine. That's the way it should be. You do a job for pay. But when you mix in the idea of, I want that job to be ministry. I want it to be helping people. You know, there's a 2-year wait right now. Just in 2007, when we went for our 501c3, we got it instantaneously. Now it's almost a 2-year wait on getting a 501c3 pushed through. Because so many people are trying to start up nonprofits because they're looking for a way to make money off the nonprofit world. They think it's like a way to make money. And we have met them. There are people that have come through the underground, and we're meeting them slowly where they come in, and we meet with them, and they have a ministry idea, and I'm excited. Of course, I always say yes to every ministry idea. And so someone has a ministry idea, I'm like, yes, we should do that. Absolutely, amen. And then slowly we get to know these people, and we realize, wait, their heart is not for ministry. Their heart is to make a living in this. It's really about money, not about the ministry. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying people who are in full-time or are called to full-time ministry should not make a living from it. That's fine. But that can't be why you got into it. Because as soon as the paycheck becomes the thing that you wake up to get, you've lost the heart of God. And you're no longer fit to be in full-time ministry. I wish that these people who every day wake up and go do full-time ministry in order to get a paycheck would recuse themselves. I wish they would step down. I wish they would have the integrity to say, I am not the right person for this position. And what I would rather have is a bunch of people that would be willing to do ministry full-time for nothing and have a community of philanthropists and other people and generous people come alongside them and say, we ought to give you a little money so you can take care of your family. This is the way that the temple should have been run. I had it last week, just Sunday, before I came up to preach, I made the mistake of reading the front page of the Tampa Tribune. I don't know if you saw it. And it was just a bad idea before I have my kind of way that what I do on a Sunday morning and getting ready to come here. And I read the article. Front page of the Tampa Tribune was the article about a prominent, used to be a prominent prosperity church in the city of Tampa, and their wayward leader, who had become a drug addict and abuser and all this stuff, was back. And now he's returned. He like literally a week earlier was in rehab, gets out, and now he's back as the pastor of this church. And if you read the article, there's a sense in which I've made mistakes, but at the same time, we're going to go back and keep teaching the same false doctrine, the same lies to our people. And this is a church that boasted once over 20,000 people. 20,000 of our people. 20,000 people from our city who loved Jesus, who cared about Jesus. 20,000 people, most of which were poor. And I'm going to tell you right now, I wish that fig tree would die. And yet, here he is back again. As you read it for yourself. As you read the story, you begin to realize, I know exactly why he's back. He has no other way to make money. There's no other way to make a living except for ministry. That's all he knows how to do, how to get money. And he knows that ministry is a way to make money. Getting services together, riling people up, and taking four offerings in the middle of that service so that you can get money. That's the way to make a living. And what they begin to call successful ministry is ministry that makes a lot of money for them. Churches that exist to make money for the people that are running them. There are those churches. They are started as a job. And I'm going to say something right now because I think it's important that it be said out loud. It's what you already probably feel in your heart. These people are thieves. And what they're doing is criminal before God. Ministry should be done because you cannot do anything else. If you're called into full-time ministry, you ought to be reluctant. As if to say, I'll try to make money anywhere else I can, any other way I can, until you find that that your calling is so profound that you have to do this with every moment of every day. And if you are called to that, which many of us are, if you are called to that, you do it reluctantly and you take as little money out of the kingdom as you possibly can. I set my own salary because I am the CEO of the organization, so I set my own salary, and I make my salary to the dollar what my family needs, not a dollar more. And if my family needs more because I have a 15-year-old son that eats like a goat, that drinks a gallon of milk and eats a loaf of bread a day, which is different than when we had little kids that would like stir their peas and throw them around and eat one. And I don't know how they live. How did little kids survive? I don't know. So if there's more money that we need, we take a little bit of more money. We have a salary scale in the underground. So anybody that comes under our umbrella, many of you who receive your pay, and this is just disclosure, we have a salary scale. And our salary scale is 2 times the poverty level. So whatever poverty level is in this country, whatever that's set at, we multiply that by 2, and that's what we think a person in ministry ought to make, not more. We don't want our people to be poor. We think people that are called in a full-time ministry have to be taken care of by the body of Christ, but at the same time, they cannot profiteer off of it. And what that does, that weeds people out. Because people start realizing, you're saying I can only make this amount of money? Yeah, if you want to be under our umbrella, yes, that's all you can make under our salary scale. Now, you can break off and be your own 501c3 and make your higher salaries. That's fine. But that's between you and your board and between you and God. But in our system, in our structure, this is how we set it. And we lose people because of that. Because it's not enough money. The true nature of temple is that it's supposed to be a place of inclusivity, community, free access to God. It's supposed to be a place of prayer and interaction with God, not of commerce. A place for people from every nation to find their way to God unhindered. Anyone can come in, but you have to leave your stuff behind. Then you can come in. It's meant to be a place of economic justice, not exploitation. Money and goods should be collected actually in the temple system, the way that God designed it. Money and goods should be collected, but then those money and goods should be given away to the priests that administer the temple and to the poor and to the alien. And this is a complete reversal of what they'd done. That the money that they'd taken in was going to the leaders instead of being given to the alien and the poor, the needy, instead of being offered as hospitality, which is why it was supposed to be taken up in the first place. This is not the will of God, not the heart of God. And yet we rebuild this exact temple. that he tore down. We rebuild its systems. You know, the primary text, if you go into one of these money-grubbing churches, the primary text that they will use is Malachi 3. Now, I find that fascinating because Malachi 3 is the culmination of Mark. Malachi 3 is the beginning of Mark, where Mark in Mark 1, where he says that John the Baptist has come as one crying out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. That's Malachi 3, 1 and 2. It's a reference to that text. And I read it last week where John is promised that this one that was promised in Malachi has come, is coming, and will make his way to temple. And if you remember the end of that passage I read last week out of Malachi 3, it says, hear the word of the Lord, that he would come and he would bring them to trial. That he would come to temple, and then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple and he will put you on trial. And this is what's happening in this passage. Malachi 3 is this moment in Mark. And what is it that churches that want money, that take up seven offerings in the middle of a service, what is it that they keep telling you, keep beating you over the head with? What is the one text they love to flaunt? It's Malachi 3, and this is what they read to you. Will a mere mortal rob God? Yet you rob me. But you ask, how have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. And this is what they'll tell you. They'll tell you that you are not giving enough money into the tithes and the offerings, and you're robbing God because you're doing it. This is the exact opposite of what Malachi 3 means. Listen carefully to it in context. Then suddenly, the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. So I will come and put you on trial. And those I will be quick to testify against you. And those who defraud laborers of their wages, who oppress the widows and the fatherless, and who deprive foreigners among you of justice. But do you not fear me, he says. Will a mere mortal rob God? In other words, you steal from the alien. You oppress and exploit the visitor and the pilgrim. And you're saying, but I couldn't rob God. No one could rob God. And he's saying, but you are robbing in tithes and offerings. Listen very carefully. Malachi is saying the people taking up the tithes and offerings. He's not talking about the people giving the tithes and offerings. He's talking about the people that collect them and keep them for themselves. And this is what he goes on to say. In tithes and offerings, you are under a curse. This is the fig tree. In tithes and offerings, you are under a curse, your whole nation, because you are robbing me. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And this is what they tell us. You ought to bring in the full tithe so that there's food in my house. And they make you think that you aren't giving enough money because you need to bring the full tithe into the storehouse. But the truth is, whatever the tithe is, whatever the people give, has now been put as stewards on those leaders that have collected that money to make sure that it all gets to the poor. Because the storehouse of God was the place in which the needy could come and get what they didn't have. What is the challenge? Who are the thieves robbing God? It is the people in the temple system taking the poor's money, taking people's money, who give out of good conscience to the work of God. And then they take that money and they keep some of it for themselves. And then they rob God, you see. Instead of bringing the full tithe into the storehouse, they put some in their pocket. That's what Malachi 3 means. I love it. I think it's a great text to be read at a prosperity gathering. And then he says this, see, if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that there will not be room enough to store it, I will prevent pests from devouring your crops, and the vines of your fields will not drop their fruit before it's ripe. And the nations will call you blessed, for yours will be a delightful land. What is the hope of God for his people? It's that we would be a generous people. but that those that are stewarding those gifts would give them away in such a way that the nations would be blessed and would delight in God because of the way that we steward the kingdom's resources. And I'm going to tell you right now, do you feel my heart on this? We cannot get this wrong. We usher in the fieriest, fiercest, most violent judgment of all the gospel in all the life of Jesus is ushered in when we get this wrong. When we take Malachi 3 and we twist it and we say, people aren't giving enough, give more to me, and then we take it and we put it in our pockets. Isn't that what people are doing? When they ask for more money from poor people that are coming to their congregation and go buy a Bentley, is that not a thief? How is that not a thief? How have they not turned the house of God into a den of robbers? This text, the whole text, Malachi 2, the whole text is written to leaders. To people that take the offer, not the people that give it. Prosperity churches are robbing their people. They rob the poor primarily. Incidentally, we had to wrestle with this question of should we, 5 years ago we said, should the underground be a church or should it be a 501c3? You know, what should we do? And how do we present ourselves to the government? How do we present ourselves? Are we a church or are we a 501c3? You know, part of the reason why we chose to be a 501c3 is because that the expectation of the government upon churches is so minimalistic. Churches can do pretty much whatever they want with money. And I'm offended by that. Remember when that congressman brought down a question of like four major national ministries, one of which being this local Tampa church, and said, we want to see your books. We want to see how you're using the money. And they said, no, you have no right to do that. Churches can do that legally. They're protected. So they can use money any way they want to. And they're not held to the same standard as a secular nonprofit. I find that offensive. I think Christians should be held not only to the same standard of a secular company or a secular nonprofit, but a higher standard. And so there was no way, when given that choice, that we were going to choose the lower standard. There was no way. We chose the higher expectation so we could say to the government, you look in on us. You make sure that we're using the money the way we say. We want those safeguards that are in place put upon us. We want to exceed those safeguards. It's not just about transparency. It's also about saying, what is moral? What is ethical? That applies to us. We're not, because we're Christian doesn't mean it doesn't apply to us. But that's exactly what people, the argument that these money-grabbing churches have made. They've said, you can't, this is God's money and no one should be able to look at it. Are you serious? It's the exact opposite. The temple system had been found by God to be robbery. There is no more scathing words in the Old Testament than Jeremiah 7:4, where Jeremiah says, do not trust these deceptive words. I mean, this is harsh words coming down the temple system. Jeremiah says, do not trust these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. This is the temple of the Lord. Jeremiah is saying, don't believe that lie, that is the temple of the Lord. And guys, it's not like all these guys, all these merchants, and they're just good people just trying to make a living and do their own thing. These are criminals who are exploiting the poor and competing with each other to see who can exploit the poor more. To see who can get more poor people to come to their booth, to give them their offerings. And now all of a sudden they're all kind of lumped into one category, like these poor victims of Jesus. You know, why is Jesus being so mean to these people? You have to understand, there was people being driven out of the temple before Jesus arrived. And it was the people that could not afford to get in. They were being driven out every day. And Jesus shows up and he says, no, I'm going to drive you out. We're going to flip the script here. And the people that are driving other people out, I'm driving you out. And it's not like they're all kind of, it's what I imagine. Remember when you're in high school or middle school and you get in a fight? I don't know if anyone ever got in a fight. And you're in a fight. I remember one time this kid did something, he said something to some girl, and I took his head and smashed into the lockers, and he took a swing at me, and then we're like scrapping at it, and then the teacher comes out, and then all of a sudden you jump up, and I'll never forget this, the kid who was like, we're just goofing off, we're just playing around. I'm like, yeah, we're like totally best friends. Remember that? These kids are trying to kill each other, and then a teacher comes, and everyone's like, what? We're good for, no, just goofing off. That's all we're doing. We're just playing around. That's kind of like what's happening here. All of a sudden, they're this unified team. You know, why are you throwing us out? We're just helping people. Here's the thing. Jesus came to save those men too. He loves them. So why would he be so violent towards them? See, this is love. Because he's driving out the ones that are driving others out. I know maybe in a small sort of sense, I know what it feels like to be driven out because of my 11th grade English class. And I had a teacher that hated me so much that he would pre-write a referral for me. And he would keep it right here, this pink slip. He kept it right there on his podium, all filled out. Ready to go. He's saving himself time. Just a time saver. And I would come in, and I can remember him saying, it got so bad that he would just say, are you going to give me trouble today? And I would say, of course, you know. And so he would just hand it to me, and I would leave. Like before the bell had rung. So apparently it caused some level of controversy because the dean got sick of me coming, instead of to English class, coming to his office every day. And he's like, we have to sort this out. So I guess he put pressure on this teacher, like, you have to keep him in your class. You have to at least try. And so what he did is he took my desk and he put it outside the classroom. I'm not kidding. So every day when I came to 11th grade English, my desk was already sitting in the hallway, and I just had to sit in my desk in the hallway. Which I didn't. I would just go on walkabout or whatever around the school. The closest I ever came to turning over tables was taking one apart. I took the time of taking a desk. I read this in a book when I was in high school, and so I got a screwdriver and I took a desk apart, every screw out of it, and I just let it sit there, like, ready to fall. And I couldn't wait for someone to sit in it. So everyone kind of comes into class, and this is, and I'm just wait. I'm so excited, you know, about this. And a few of my friends know about it, so they're like, can't wait, you know, to see what happens. And no one sat in it. It was like the back. I was like, come on. So we're in like the middle of class and no one's sitting in it. And so I'm like, screw it. So I just get up and I go sit in it. And it breaks into a million pieces, you know, all over the... Not sure why I told you that story. I wasn't the best kid. I wasn't the easiest kid to have in class. In fact, I think I was the first person to ever be promoted because of bad behavior. So what happened was the teacher, went to the dean, and this is probably mortifying my parents right now, but my teacher went to the dean and said, I cannot have this person in my class. You have to get him out of the class. And apparently there was some kind of rule that you could not demote a kid for behavior. So you couldn't put him in, like, I was in advanced English, and so you couldn't put me in, like, average English because I had a behavior problem, so they had to promote me to AP English. So I'm pretty sure I was the only kid ever, at least maybe at the time, to be promoted because of bad behavior. And it was wonderful. Something different about the class, something different about the teacher. it wasn't a problem. I wasn't a problem. But what we really had was we had a teacher originally that was so tied up in his rules and regulations. There was no room for me. There was no room for joy or creativity. And there was no room for laughter. And so I was the enemy. And in this other class, there was room for that. And there was room for me. I find that interesting. I was unconsciously rebelling against a system of rules and oppression, a loveless system, more concerned with teachers' rules than with students actually growing and learning. It reminds me of that quote from Wolfgang Simpson, who says, "A rebel is just a radical without his father's heart." People rebel because inside them there is a radical, someone that wants a better world, a better system. See, the problem is not the people. The problem is the temple itself. Jesus came to save those people. I mean, they were making mistakes, for sure. But the system itself was broken. The system itself was twisting people. And the problem was the leaders who managed that system. Because it was no longer a system of inclusivity or reconciliation for the nations, but it had become a system of exclusion and exploitation and abuse. And Jesus does violence to that system that is oppressing people. Jesus is not violent towards the people themselves that he hopes to save. He is happy for them to come back in as long as they leave their prophets behind. But he comes violently against the system itself. He has come to promote them for their bad behavior, to kick them out of the false temple and to offer them entrance into the true temple. I read an interesting piece of research that was done in 2000. And what they did is they took, it was about unhealthy eating habits. Just a little loud. It's kind of ringing. They were looking at unhealthy eating habits. And so they took people that were going into the movie theaters, and they gave every single person that would see this one movie a free tub of popcorn. But the difference was some people got a massive tub, like a jumbo, like you could take a bath in it. It was so big, tub of popcorn. And then other people, they got like a medium-sized tub of popcorn. But here's the thing. Both tubs were impossible for one person to eat the whole thing. So nobody in the whole study actually ate all the popcorn. So inexhaustible supply of popcorn, but the difference was the size of the container. And what the researchers were trying to figure out is, would people eat more just because the container is bigger? Now, the other thing they did is they made the popcorn horrific. They left it out for 5 days. It squeaked when you ate it. It tasted like styrofoam. Because they didn't want, oh, this is so delicious. They didn't want that to be something that corrupted their research. So this is like foul popcorn, and they're giving people a big, huge, you can't eat it all, medium-sized container, and you cannot eat it all, jumbo container. And they gave it to them. And then what they did is they weighed the popcorn before they went in, and they weighed it after. And what they discovered was that the people that actually took the big jumbo popcorn ate 52% more popcorn than the people with the medium-sized popcorn. And I said, it's free, and it's inexhaustible. You're never going to get to the bottom of it, and it's gross. But that is an average of 21 more handfuls that the jumbo bucket people ate than the medium bucket people. Now, what's interesting about it is that when people were asked about it, they told them what they were doing. People said, well, you know, that's not going to work on me. I have a good sense of my limit. And everyone just, you know, I know when I'm full. And I don't, those kind of things don't really work on me. But it did. It worked on every single one. To a person, if you got a jumbo thing, you ate 52% more popcorn than the people with a medium. Now, if you were to take that data and look at it and say, I don't know, try to analyze it, but not look at the container. If you were to just say, okay, we gave people an inexhaustible supply of popcorn and these people ate 21 more handfuls than these people, what would you deduce? You have a group, some people are gluttonous and some people aren't. Some people just overeat. Some people just have more desire to eat more gross popcorn. That's what you would deduce, and that would be wrong. Because the problem was not actually people's desire to eat more. It was the size of the container that caused it. This is the problem of the temple. You give people the wrong size container for God and they will miss Him. This is the big container for God, but is it even big enough? People come to temple and they took part in a broken system because the system called them into it, because it invited them into it, because it just made sense for them to do that. And to say that some people just like to be deceived or some people just like to be robbed is to miss the point completely. We have to at some point look at the containers and say maybe the problem is the container. More to the point, not is our temple big enough, but actually is our temple small enough for God? And this is how Jesus finishes. The last thing He does is He teaches. He throws out the merchants. He flips over the tables. He blocks, bars the entry. And finally, He teaches. Once He has restored order to temple, He teaches about the true temple. And now He starts talking about things we're familiar with, things we're comfortable with, things like faith and prayer and answered prayer and forgiveness. These are things that Western Christians get. These are things that Western Christians like talking about. These are things we make magnets about and put on our refrigerators. When we're talking about overthrowing the temple, when we're talking about direct action, when we're talking about getting a group of people to throw over tables and bar the entryways to corrupt religious systems, we don't understand that. We don't like that. We don't want anything to do with that. But now let's talk about faith, and let's talk about prayer, and let's talk about moving mountains. Now that we like. But you cannot separate those two here, can you? They are inextricably bound. Because when Jesus is talking about moving a mountain with your prayers, when He's talking about moving mountains with your faith, He's talking about taking a corrupt religious system and stopping the cogs of its wheels, throwing your body on the machinery, ending its tyranny. He's talking about direct action against evil. When He says faith, He's not talking about something inside your heart, like a little flickering flame that now you believe, and because you believe, that mountain must move. He's talking about a lifetime of faithful action. When Jesus says faith and the life of faith, when He says, if you have faith in God, believe in God, He's talking about your life being laid down against a power that is bigger than you. Again, it's a religious infrastructure that will crush you. Standing against it as a small band of resistance fighters and saying, you can't come in here. And doing violence to the system that does violence to the weakest. That's faith. That's prayer. That's a move now. We struggle with this word about prayer, because we know that every time we have prayed that a mountain be moved, it does not move. And we wonder why. What is wrong with our prayers? And we ask ourselves, well, maybe I don't believe enough. And so what we think is that what we have to do is we have to have a stronger faith. Because Jesus is saying here, if you really believed in it, it would really happen. And so we think, okay, am I not right about this? So we think, okay, I have to believe more. I have to believe harder. And then my prayers will be more effective, so I have to believe harder. What do we mean when we say we have to believe harder? We have to do this like internal scrunching and constricting and tensing, and we have to say, now I believe, you know. I believe. Constipated Christian prayer, you know. I believe. I guess I didn't believe enough. The mountain did not move. Man, I could not move that mountain. Let me try harder. Oh! Still didn't move. But what if that isn't what He means at all by faith? What if we took the earlier story of the withered fig tree and the withered temple? What if we took their action of what they had done all day, an entire day's work, a day that they could, It's something they could not have done in an evening when they first walked into Jerusalem. What if they looked at that day's work and they said, now that's a metaphor for faith. Us working together as a team, flipping over wicked systems, overthrowing them, barring the doors so that people have access to God, but only in the right way, in a way that is pure, in a way that is not corrupted by money or greed or racism. What if we stood together and put our effort, and under the leadership of Jesus, and we put our effort into stopping these wicked systems, into throwing our bodies on the machine parts? And what if we did that? What if that's actually faith? And what if mountains could be moved in our cities and in our nation and in our world? What if mountains could be moved, but they had to be moved because of the application of a lifetime of faith? Not the straining of the mind to believe a thing that seems unbelievable, but the living of a life toward the changing of a thing that seems like it cannot be changed. The living of a life that believes in God before it believes in the power of this system that is in place. And there are people that must have looked at the temple system and said, who could ever overthrow this? Who could ever undo this? And Jesus' response to them is, believe in God. Don't believe in this system, believe in God. Believe also in me. And he's saying to them, come with me, watch what I can do. It's just a day's work. But can you imagine what Jesus could do with the faith of a few over a lifetime? If they could do this to this temple, the center of this nation, the center of this city, the center of their commerce, the center of all the corruption and the greed, if he could go in there and see this kind of change in one day, what could he do with a group of people who give them their life? So there's a connection between faith and God and overthrown tables. In fact, I don't believe there is the possibility of real discipleship without some overturned tables. And the truth is, we come from a people, a nation, a culture, which wants to have true discipleship with no overturned tables. We want Jesus to waltz into our house exactly as it is and leave everything unchanged and untouched, and let us teach us how to be like Him in a world, in a system, in a bucket so big that He cannot fit. To be like Him and yet to leave all these vestiges of evil and wickedness. And if you would let Jesus come and be the Lord and Master of your life, He will throw over some tables. Let me invite these guys up so I can finish. He does not just tear them down. He does not just tear this temple down, but He rebuilds their hearts. How will we have a relationship with God without temple? This is what they're wondering. That's fine. If we tear down temple, then what do we have left without this system? It's a shock to them. So He gives them the real thing. And I find this interesting. You know, Peter just was a part of this direct action against the temple, which must have seemed to him to be the strongest, most powerful thing in his life, in the visage of his eyes. And yet he was just a part of like putting a stop to that whole system for a day. And you know what he notices at the end of the day? What does he notice? The tree. So he spent the whole day with Jesus doing this. And I'm sure Peter was at the head of like leading the charge. Like, we're flipping over tables today? Heck yeah! And he's like, flipping tables today. That's finally something I can do, you know, like a ministry thing that fits me. Because Peter was a brawler, you know what I mean? I just see him with these knobby, gnarly hands. He's like, finally. So they're blocking the door. Peter loves it. I'm this conjecture, but I'm imagining Peter at the gate like, you're not coming in here, dude. Put that down, and then you can come in or not. I'm knocked down. You cannot get in here. He's happy, you know. And he's been a part of this extraordinary display of power, the stopping of this system. But he was a part of it. And so he belittles it. And this is what we do. Because he took part in it, because it just seemed like the disciples just being given assignments, and they did their assignments like, you two hold that door, and you two throw those tables out, and they were... all the group was kind of working together, and because of that, he doesn't see it as extraordinary. And this is what we do. We look at the withered fig tree and we say, a miracle! I can't believe it! It's a miracle!
This is a bait. What? You said it and then it happened. What? No way. But to miss the power of what they had done all day. Because that fig tree was cursed too. And it will wither. It did wither. Within a generation, that whole temple will be gone. Peter's amazed by the fig tree withering and not the temple withering. Jesus says a word to the tree and it dies. And that's supernatural. That's amazing. But he also that day organized a direct action against a deadly system. But we're only fascinated by supernatural miracles, things that we think happen in a moment or an instant. And we're not as amazed as we should be at a life well lived that changes a street or a group of people or changes the statistics of a city in ways we'll never know. We'll never know because of the work you're doing. We'll never know the kids that don't get pregnant, don't have abortion, or don't go to jail, or don't murder somebody. We'll never know the crimes that aren't committed. Because righteousness has come into the hearts of some. And so we're wowed by the miracle when we should be wowed by the exercise of a life of faith. Don't miss the power of it. You do not doubt in your heart. For me, that means persistent obedience. A lifetime of committed action, not doubting. Every day waking up and saying, I'll believe again that this is possible. I'll believe again that kids can be rescued. I'll believe again that vulnerable women can be saved. I'll believe again that the homeless can find homes. I'll believe again that the fatherless can be brought back into families. I'll believe again that the sick can be made well. I'll believe again for inclusion, the disabled. I'll believe again in the possibility of the poor finding sustenance in God. I'll believe again. I will not have doubt in my heart. Not to strain some internal thing, but in the living out of my life in such a way that believes that that is possible. And stays committed to that prayer every day. I want to leave you with this question. What mountain do you want moved? I'm serious. You personally. What mountain stands in your way? What mountain stands between you and what you know is justice and righteousness and goodness of God in the specific calling that He's given you for the specific people that He's called you? What is that mountain? What system are you called with the faithfulness of your life to shut down? To gather a team of people under the leadership of Jesus and to move them in direct action protests against that system so that in the course of your life, that mountain will be moved. You answer that question and you have figured out the trajectory of the rest of your life. You have figured out what it means to be a disciple. If you cannot answer that question today, then you are not a disciple. Because our discipleship, our faithfulness to Jesus means confronting these mountains. And in faith, because we believe in Him, seeing those mountains move. You know what it is. If you just look in your heart, if you just ask God, He'll show you. A lot of you know that JL works at Chick-fil-A. And she has a manager who is a really good guy. I don't think I've met him, but she tells very nice stories about him. But he just decided to leave. He's going to go do another kind of career thing. And so last night he pulled JL aside. This is his last night working there. He pulled her aside and he sat her down and he just wanted to give her some like parting words or something. And in effect, this is what he said to her. He just said, look,
This is great. You're a great worker. You know, you're doing good job here. But if I just want you to know, you were made for more than this. Now, I think that's really sweet. I'm pretty sure my daughter already knew she was not made for Chick-fil-A her whole lifetime or whatever. But, you know, I think that sentiment, you know, was well placed. In other words, don't get stuck here. Don't try to advance here. You're destined for something greater than Chick-fil-A. And I think to myself, you know, duh. It's the right thing to say, and it's something I want to say to you. Maybe some of you have never heard that, and I just want you to know you're destined for more than what you're doing right now. And some of you are in your calling, you know where you are, you know that mountain, you know it, bam, you know exactly what needs to be moved. But some of you still don't know. Some of you work at Chick-fil-A, and I mean that in a metaphorical sense. And I just want you to know that is not the fullness of the life that God has called you to. There is more. Can we sing the third song again? That's how we had planned. Yes. Spontaneity. This is what it looks like. What I like about this lyric is something about the presence of God, ushering in the presence of God. See, we call in the presence of God, but you have to understand, when Jesus walks into a corrupt place, he throws tables. And the desire for the presence of God in the world around us is a desire for the overthrowing of tables. But it is also a desire for healing and wholeness, all those other things that we know we want. It's like, this is the work of ministry. It is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comforted. So as we ask for the presence of God, we remember His presence in this meal. The church has always maintained that Jesus is uniquely present at this table in a way that He is not present in anything else. He comes in this meal, in the taking of this meal, in the eating of this bread, and the drinking of this juice. He is present. We accept, we believe, we usher in His presence and all that that means. And I hope today that when you think about His presence, you think about it in a different way. You think about the whip in His hands and the fire in His eyes. And you will give Him access. As you take these elements into your body, you will give Him access to overthrow that which needs to be overthrown and to heal that which needs to be healed. On the night He was betrayed, He took bread, and after giving thanks, He broke it. He said, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Eat it to remember me." In the same way, after supper, He took the cup and He said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, shed for the forgiveness of sin. Drink it to remember me." This is the presence of God. Come and take the body and blood of Jesus given to you.